What's up, Stitches? Here we are on episode 3 of season 3 of So What. I'm Isabella Rosner, and I am the host of this here pod, and today we are getting into the second interview of the season. The interview is with the wonderful Emily Wells, a PhD student at the College of William & Mary, where she researches the geography of white Southern American girlhood prior to the Civil War. Luckily for me and the listeners of So What, Emily's research on geography before the 1860s involves a heck of a lot of needlework. We love to see it, don't we? Yes, we do. And because we love to see it, my interview with Emily is all about geography and needlework, a hugely exciting subject because I haven't talked about anything close to that since briefly discussing map samplers in season 1. And discussing needlework and geography is important because geography is obviously universal, and it's been included in needlework in a whole variety of ways over time. After all, we all have places and spaces, and stitching is a really good way to ground ourselves in those. Emily Wells is a delight of a human being, and this is her bio, which I have taken straight from the College of William & Mary website. Quote, Emily graduated magna cum laude from Mount Holyoke College in 2015 with a BA in history. In 2017, Emily received a MA in history from William & Mary. Her master's portfolio examined the relationship between novels and female education during the early national period with a focus on the Gothic and seduction genres. Emily's dissertation, Keep Within Compass, Geography and Girlhood in the American South, 1783-1865, examines the relationship between place and identity among elite white girls who lived in the American South during the early national and antebellum periods. Emily has pursued her academic interests outside of the classroom through internships with museums and cultural institutions, including Colonial Williamsburg, Historic Deerfield, Old Sturbridge Village, the American Antiquarian Society, and the Mount Holyoke College Archives and Special Collections. She also completed an editorial apprenticeship at the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and Culture. End quote. Also, Emily and I followed each other on Twitter for a long time before I moved to Colonial Williamsburg in Williamsburg, Virginia, and we met in person and we became fast friends. And I just want to say, what a testament to online friendships and Twitter mutuals and the power of the internet that now here we are on this podcast together talking about needlework. That is just incredibly wholesome to me, and I love it so much. And briefly, before I get to my classic social media spiel, just want to say that even though Emily's dissertation focuses on white girls in the South, our conversation is very, very far from that subject only. We talk a lot about white girls, but also about how their needlework education and their lives depended on the enslavement of Black individuals in the South, and the important issues that need to be discussed and sort of untangled when one considers white girl stitching in that place and time. So just to say, this podcast episode is not limited to discussing white girls, nor should it be. Okay, and now before we get into the interview, it's social media spiel time. We know this, we love this, we're gonna do it. So as you probably know very well at this point, images of everything we discuss in the interview, as well as links to sources, books, social media pages, and whatever else we talk about, are all up on the So What social media pages. That's at So What Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And this here humble pod also has a website, sowhatpodcast.com, and a Patreon, patreon.com/sowhatpodcast. That's available if you want to help support us, and when I say us, I mean me, because podcasting is expensive. If you're not able to, that is so fine. I'm honestly just happy you're here. Also, a tiny bit of context about two things. One, we briefly talk about Westtown Globes in the interview, and I gotta explain them to you because just the term Westtown Globe doesn't actually mean anything, unless, of course, you are already familiar with what they are. Westtown Globes are three-dimensional embroidered globes stitched by girls at Westtown School, which was a Quaker school, it still is a Quaker school, founded in Pennsylvania in 1799. Girls would create a sphere out of silk wrapped around raw wool, and then embroider and write upon that globe to create a fully detailed map. These objects are really, truly bonkers in the best way possible, and are some of the most amazing examples of embroidered objects from any time and any place, in my humble opinion. You really need to see pictures of them, and luckily for you, images are on the So What social media pages. Also, you'll probably notice in the interview that we mention my personal interest in Quakers. For those of you who are new to the pod, you may not know that my PhD focuses on Quaker women's art before 1800. A huge part of my research is about 17th century Quaker stitching. So yeah, if you're curious about why I get excited when Emily mentions the Quakers, that's why. Yay, Quakers! And now that I've done a bunch of explaining about a bunch of different things, let's get to the interview, shall we? Yes, we shall. Here it is. Hi, Emily. Thank you so much for being here today. I am incredibly excited to talk to you about your work.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So, big question, vague question, but a question nevertheless. What exactly is your PhD about, and how did you come to research that?
Yeah, so my PhD research is on girlhood in the American South, specifically during the early national and antebellum periods. So essentially, I go from the end of the American Revolution to the end of the Civil War. And specifically, I'm looking at how girls experienced and thought about place. So for example, I look at how they used place as a narrative device in their letters, and also how they depicted their relationship to place in visual art like needlework. And my journey to this topic really started during my first year of college. So in my history classes, I found myself continually gravitating towards topics that examined how people thought about and experienced place. So I was looking at things like property law and landscape design. And a little later, I started to become interested in the history of female education. So at the time, I was attending Mount Holyoke College, which is a women's college that was initially founded as a female seminary in the 1830s. And I think this environment is what really sparked my interest in this topic. And so these two interests, thinking about place and thinking about women's education, led me to the topic of geography education, which is what I ended up writing my undergraduate thesis on, and until very recently was what I intended to write about for my dissertation. But as I kind of got further and further into my research during grad school, I began to realize that I was less interested in the formal educational structures that girls experienced and more interested in the emotional and intellectual lives of students, whether inside or outside of the classroom. So that's kind of how I arrived at my current dissertation topic. Geography education is definitely a huge part of it, but I also look at how girls thought about and experienced place in their everyday lives, outside of the classroom, in their homes, and in anywhere they happen to be.
I love that. And that's so beautifully said. I find it really powerful and important, especially because this is something I've been thinking about a lot. In the US, we don't really have a geography education. In fifth grade, I had to memorize all the states and their capitals, but I never learned about the world beyond America. And living in the UK, I have learned that that is an actual course that people take. They are specifically taught about geography. You can major in geography at university. And I have actually been thinking about your PhD topic quite a lot recently, as I think about this idea that at some point along the line, our education really went from clearly being, if not fully focused on geography, having geography as a pretty important part of one's education, to in the American school system, not having geography be a thing at all. 150 years after the end of the period you're looking at geography, maybe I'm just projecting my own experience, but like geographical education in the US feels fairly non-existent.
Oh no, definitely. I think my most prominent memory of geography education in school was singing 50 Nifty United States.
What a tune.
Which is a wonderful, wonderful little song, but it's not the same degree of knowledge or education that these girls were getting back in the 18th and 19th centuries.
What role does needlework play in your research? And can you tell me more about the types of needlework you're engaging with in your project?
Of course. So there are a lot of ways that girls engage with geography through needlework. Some of the earliest examples I can think of are depictions of, you know, like the four continents on needlework pictures produced during the 17th century, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
But that being said, a lot of parents and educators didn't really prioritize or even consider geography education for girls until around the 1760s. And girls didn't even begin to produce embroidered maps until about the 1770s. The earliest reference to this practice that I'm aware of is an article that was published in August 1776 in an issue of the Ladies' Magazine. That credits the idea, of course, to an unnamed governess, because why would we credit?
Classic move. Oh.
Exactly. So that's the earliest reference to this practice that I am aware of. Maybe there's earlier references, but we don't really even see these maps start to appear until the 1780s, 1790s, at least the maps that survive today. And this practice, like all, you know, educational fashions and innovations that happened in England, it eventually made its way over to the United States. And several schools began to advertise the working of maps as a way to draw in potential customers. And the practice never really reached the same degree of popularity in the US as it did in Britain. And while there are a fairly large number of surviving embroidered maps that were made in the United States, a lot of these maps can actually be traced to a small number of schools. Mm. So actually, like, about half of all extant embroidered maps that were made in the United States were produced at the same Quaker boarding school in New York. Which,
the Quakers strike again.
No, the Quakers, this is something I need to look into more, but a lot of our embroidered maps and globes in the United States come from Quaker schools. So that being said, there is a lot of interesting variation among embroidered maps produced in the United States. Some of my personal favorites are maps of Washington, D.C. and Boston Harbor that are really like very overtly patriotic, complete with like eagles and portraits of George Washington, which are just, they're delightful. And then, of course, there are the embroidered globes produced at Westown, which was and still is a Quaker boarding school in Pennsylvania. And about 40 of these globes survive, which is pretty amazing in and of itself. And I've actually had the chance to look at a number of them held at the school's archive and at a local historical society, and they are just delightful.
Oh, what a treat. They are so, they just bring me such joy.
Oh, me too. There's one globe where a girl switched the names of China and America, and I find that just so adorable.
Charming.
So that's wonderful. Like, I know.
Oh, that's like how I feel when a girl will like stitch, you know, like a letter backwards. Like I've seen some samplers where like B's and D's are switched, and like an S just goes in a bunch of different directions. I'm like, we forget that these are children and people, and they're making honest and honestly quite charming mistakes.
We think of maps, you know, in general as being very precise objects and very accurate. There's a lot of weight behind the word accurate, but we think of them as being these very scientific objects. And then seeing maps where girls have either made mistakes, quote unquote, or have deviated in some way from the source material is just really interesting to look at. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of extant embroidered maps from the American South. And it's not really clear whether this is because this practice was just less popular among Southern educators, or if it's because just like in general, textile objects from the South are more rare than those from the North due to things like climate and war and things that are difficult for textiles to survive. But that being said, actually one of the most interesting and unusual geographical embroideries was made by a girl from South Carolina. So there is a needlework picture that's currently in a private collection. But which is on loan currently, I think on loan to a museum in Charleston, that is attributed to Emma Louisa Leno Gildersleeve. I apologize if I mispronounced her
That's a
name.
long name.
I know. And since Emma Louisa was a girl from Charleston, and scholars think that this picture, needlework picture, is a self-portrait made by her. And in this picture, we see a girl who is possibly Emma Louisa seated in front of a table that holds a globe and a map of South Carolina. And in her right hand, she holds a compass. And now, when I say compass, I don't mean like a magnetic compass like we would think of today, but more of a V, kind of adjustable V-shaped tool that people use to measure the distance on a map.
Oh my God.
I know, it's amazing.
I'm
And
like emotional about this, to be honest.
I know. When I found it, I was just like, where have you been my whole life? And so this picture is really interesting for a lot of different reasons. So as you probably know, there's not a lot of needlework pictures that include self-portraits of the makers. And the fact that this girl chose to depict herself alongside a range of geographical instruments really drives home how important geography was, not just as a form of knowledge, but also as a social signifier. So the girl who stitched this wanted to demonstrate that she had received the best education that money could buy. And by including a map of South Carolina, she specifically aligned herself with the ruling class of that state, specifically the ruling class of Charleston. And going even further, her decision to depict herself holding a compass carries a lot of symbolic significance. So, as you probably know from at least the 17th century, the compass was a popular metaphor for virtue, especially female virtue. And you've probably heard like the men and women were supposed to keep within compass,
Totally.
which essentially meant to follow a virtuous life path and not commit any social transgressions. And I think that by showing herself holding a compass, she is making a statement about her personal virtue, which was, of course, in turn her ticket into a socially advantageous marriage. So there's a lot going on here, and it really shows how geography education was really intimately connected to social status.
I guess I find it so fascinating that there is a lack of map samplers and geography samplers generally in the US because, well, several reasons. One, the US is becoming a thing at this time, right? It's finding its footing as a country, not yet a global superpower, but as it's finding its place in the world. And I would think that for its citizens, finding the country's place in the world would come with wanting to physically map it in the world generally, to teach its citizens where in the world they are, what is around them, how are they connected to Europe, which they had so much trade with, where are they in comparison to the rest of the Americas, which they're physically connected to. So interesting also that it feels like there's a lot of micro, okay, this is a weird phrase that I'm coming up with right now, micro mapping of girls' lives. So, so many American samplers, much more so than English or European samplers, with the exception of maybe Scottish samplers. American samplers, everybody has a house on their samplers, whether it's a house or a school building or, a depiction of the church near them or whatever. There's so many American samplers have a physical place as part of their work. And I find it's so interesting that these girls are stitching their immediate surroundings, whether that is an actual depiction of where they live or where they are taught or an idealized version, but they are not taught to think geographically beyond that one spot, beyond their immediate setting.
Yeah, there is a lot of local landscape in American samplers, which it does kind of lead one to a conclusion that, well, maybe this was intentional. Maybe they were trying to focus girls' attention on the home and on their local community, which I think there's a lot that could be said there. And although there aren't a lot of embroidered maps, especially in comparison to Britain, at the same time, there are a good number of, manuscript maps, maps that were made with pen and watercolor. So geography was incredibly important during this time as a topic of instruction. It's just that the specific tradition of map embroidery didn't make its way over, which is really unfortunate for people like me who love needlework and love geography. But yeah, it is very interesting how this tradition seems like it would have been tailor-made for the United States during this time. And they just don't adopt it to the same degree as they adopted it in Britain.
So, can you tell me more about what kind, if any kind, of geographical needlework was being made by non-elite girls in the American South? Because I know you're studying elite girls and their education in the American South, but when, at least when I think of that time period and that place, I can't help but think of the girls enslaved, or otherwise who were operating in the same geographical spaces as these elite girls.
Yeah, that's a really interesting and important question. So, as you just said, my research does focus on this very privileged set of white girls living in the American South. And these girls usually attended very elite private academies and seminaries where they were taught this knowledge and taught these skills. There are a few examples of embroidered mats made by non-elite girls at public schools, mainly in the North. And these maps primarily date to the 1830s and 1840s. And by this time, the practice of map embroidery had really fallen out of fashion among the elite. But those are kind of their aberrations. They weren't, it's not like map embroidery was a really, pervasive practice in public schools. It was just like these
Gotcha.
particular schools had this, did this practice basically. But interestingly, there is evidence that there was a small number of non-white girls who attended school alongside their elite white counterparts, both in England and America. And so that means it's possible that these girls were in these schools producing these map embroideries and map drawings alongside their white counterparts. And most of these girls would have been perceived as white. Would have probably been light-skinned and would have had the support of wealthy white family members. But in the records, there is evidence of people referring to girls of color who were in these schools, and it was kind of known who, there was somewhat known, but it wasn't open knowledge, basically. And then at the same time, there were schools, like the one established by the Oblate Sisters of Providence in Maryland, that catered specifically to the free Black population. And while these institutions usually taught both geography and needlework, there are unfortunately no known extant embroidered maps made by free Black girls. This question really becomes even trickier when we consider the education and lived experiences of enslaved girls. Within the context of slavery, geographical knowledge was powerful and could be potentially subversive. And displacement and physical separation was a form of violence that almost every enslaved girl experienced at some point in her life. So while white girls could locate themselves on a map and exercise a significant degree of agency over their mobility, enslaved girls did not have the same privilege. And this reality is often represented in needlework, but not always in ways that are very obvious. So, for example, in her new book, All That She Carried, Tia Miles examines an embroidered bag that belonged to an enslaved girl named Ashley. And it was given to Ashley by her mother, Rose, just before Ashley was forcibly removed from her home and sold to another enslaver. And Rose filled this bag with necessities like a dress and some pecans, but she also put a braid of her hair for Ashley to remember her by. And years later, Ashley's granddaughter stitched her grandmother's story of displacement and loss onto this bag, which at that point had become a family heirloom. So I kind of see this bag almost as a counter narrative to the maps stitched by elite white girls, because while these embroidered maps represented their privileged place within white society, Ashley's bag tells a different story that centers on physical and social displacement.
That's true. And that's really beautifully said. I am surprised that Ashley's bag has not come up on the podcast thus far. So thank you. You are so right in thinking, I think, about that object as essentially a foil to all of these map samplers and geographical learning exercises, because it the map samplers represent movement and they represent connection in the world between people and places, but there is no movement in them, if that makes sense. Whereas Ashley's bag is not preoccupied with its place in the world or anything like that, but its existence and the interventions that have been included in it, I'm thinking of the embroidery on it later, like purely represent movement and human connection across the world, across space and time.
Well, and the fact that by embroidering her grandmother's story onto the bag, Ashley's granddaughter almost, she kind of placed Ashley within a family and within the community. Whereas initially, this bag had represented her separation from community and her separation from family. And I think it's such an interesting narrative because you go from displacement to belonging. And I love it. And I love thinking about it in terms of mobility and belonging and place and what it can tell us about the experience of enslaved girls versus the experience of this very privileged set of elite white girls.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes, absolutely. And there's something that the whole thing is obviously incredibly poignant. And I think one of the things that's extra poignant to me is the fact that the bag and the samplers use the same material and are even similar in dimension. You know, like I don't know how, I actually don't know the size of the bag, but it has a very, you know, it looks like a piece of linen in the same dimensions as some sort of map sampler, where it's slightly taller than it is long. And it's like both of these objects have used the same canvas for extremely different purposes to tell very, very different stories.
No, that is such an interesting point. And there's totally a very just a very there's a lot of material similarities between these objects. And when you put them together, they tell different stories, but these stories are connected because the same society produced both of them.
Totally. And I mean, well, the girls who were stitching the map samplers inevitably had interactions with Ashley and other enslaved individuals like her. You know, like I think, and I'm sure that's what you're doing in your PhD, you have to reckon with the fact that these elite girls, elite white girls you're looking at in the American South, were not stitching and were not learning geography and embroidery in a bubble or in a vacuum. Their families probably enslaved people. Their families likely made their money through enslaved labor. This is the material evidence of, I mean, just one piece of the much larger story of the fact that geographical education in that place and time was inevitably intimately tied to the enslavement of people.
Oh, of course. And most of the girls I study, if not all, had came from a family that enslaved people. And sometimes these girls, even when they were stitching these maps and these samplers, they themselves owned enslaved people. They had enslaved people in their name.
Oof.
I know. And there are instances where you come across in the record of enslaved people being sold to specifically fund tuition for girls and boys to go to school. There is an instance where a girl was sent to school with an enslaved girl, probably around her same age, and the enslaved girl was there to work in lieu of tuition. And the reason this is in the record is because the enslaved girl ran away, and the girl, the white girl whose tuition she had been paying, was sent home because of that.
So what people listening to this podcast can't see right now, but what Emily can see is like, I am fully losing it right now. Like, I am like leaned back in my chair. I am like rolling around. That has fully taken me out. That.
There are, I mean, in almost every case, the education of Southern girls is funded by slavery, but there are some of these instances where it is so directly funded by slavery, and it is so just, it just really kind of drives home how much of elite white society like was, you know, built upon this institution. And that's one of the reasons I actually chose to focus on the American South, because even though basically every elite white girl in America benefited in some way from the institution of slavery and the wealth that it produced, the connection is so much clearer in the South. And there is so much brutality that goes along with Southern education. And I find that to be really interesting because a lot of times when we think, it's like when we think of girls and we think of girls' education, we think of it in such a positive light, or a kind of like, oh, look at these cute little embroideries that these girls
Totally.
did for 10 years old and adorable. But there is so much violence behind it.
Hello, small note here. Emily very understandably got two case studies mixed up at this point, and both Emily and I feel it's important to get that straightened out. The case of the girl being sent home from school after the enslaved girl she used to pay her tuition ran away is mostly correct. However, it was actually two enslaved servants whose age and gender are not specified. There is another case study where a school principal hires out a 14-year-old enslaved girl as a cotton picker, ostensibly to support the running of the school. Emily conflated those two stories, which is super understandable given the spontaneous nature of this part of our conversation. But it's important to clarify these two stories not only to tell you, the listeners, the most accurate information, but also to honor those enslaved individuals who were horribly exploited to further the education of white girls in the American South. Okay, back to the interview. I'm going to ask one of my favorite questions, a question I ask everybody. If you can you tell me what is your favorite needleworked object or objects? You don't have to pick one because I know it's often like a truly impossible task.
Oh yeah, no, this is such an impossible question because I could list off hundreds
Yeah, this
of
is why I like love to ask people this because I can't pick one. So I'm like, but I can make other people pick one.
Yeah. Well, we've already talked about the piece that is probably my current favorite, which is Emma Louisa's needlework picture. But that being said, I really love seeing how the tradition of embroidered maps has carried over into the 20th and 21st centuries. So, for example, there's a map stitched by a British woman in the midst of World War II. Her name was Florence Hudson Steeger. Again, apologize if I'm mispronouncing. And she stitched a map of Great Britain to soothe her nerves and reassure herself that the nation would survive the war intact. And it really resembles in a lot of ways the embroideries that were done during the 18th and 19th centuries by girls in Britain. So that, you know, that's one object that I find to be just really interesting and really poignant.
Love that.
More recently, a woman named Shannon Downey used social media to organize a quilting project, which you're probably aware of, called the Rita's Quilt, in which stitchers across the United States and Canada worked together to finish a map quilt that a woman named Rita Smith had begun in the 1970s. And this project received a good deal of media attention, and it prompted a lot of really interesting conversations about, you know, nationalism and territorial sovereignty and how craftivism or craft-centered activism often privileges the voices of white women. And so these are just a couple of examples of how geography and needlework continue to exist, to coexist. And I find it fascinating that this tradition has continued to grow and evolve.
Great examples, great favorite objects. I hadn't even considered the like
the relevance of Shannon Downey's project, which truly took over my social media feeds for a while, and I loved it very much. And I think she's still, I still see her post about that because it's been really influential. Geography is still extremely present in needlework, especially in examples like that. And I think it actually, I think probably will tie to the next question I'm going to ask you, but I do think there is something that people love and are drawn to about geography and stitch because it forces one to contend with or to celebrate or to think about one's place in the world. What do you think the role of needlework is in today's world?
So this is always one of my favorite part, one of my favorite parts of these podcasts because because I love listening to all of the different answers that you get from the people you interview. And I think it really shows that how today and throughout history, needlework and textiles touch on so many aspects of the human experience. Mm-hmm. And so many people, and people have so many different types of relationships to this topic. So for me personally, needlework is a way to connect with people across time and space. So in my academic work, it's provided me with a way to access and listen to the voices and stories of people who did not leave an extensive written record. Mm-hmm. And in my personal life, it's a way to connect with others, such as yourself, hey, who share interests, even though we might live miles apart. Mm-hmm. So like, if you'll allow me a little corny metaphor, it's kind of like a thread that binds people together and provides a foundation for mutual understanding.
Yes. Wonderfully said. So succinct and so true. Last question. Time to hype yourself to the world. How can people learn more about your work? And do you have anything you'd like to promote?
Yeah, so I don't have anything to promote quite yet. I'm still in the trenches of the dissertation.
Also, we are in a pandemic, so that does make sense.
We are in a pandemic. That is very true. But if anyone would like to connect or learn more about my research, I'm pretty active on Twitter and Instagram. My Twitter is E_P_Wells. And my Instagram is KeepWithinCompass.
Thank you for the social media handles. I will post them across the So What social media pages. How many times can I say the word social in one sentence? And thank you so much for this amazing conversation. I've really had the best time. I've learned an incredible amount of good things and also things that have rocked me to my very core, which I think that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. Part of, I think, the joy of textiles is that, I don't know, it really, they run the gamut of the entire human experience. We get the good stuff, but we also get the really terrible stuff. And that's important. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
What a treat.
Good interview, right? If I do say so myself, I'm not saying that I did a good job interviewing. I'm just saying the conversation was good. Anyway, much to think about. Our conversation went in some unexpected directions, which I'm grateful for because it led to a really important conversation about white Southern girlhood in the context of American slavery. Emily is so right, you can't divorce studying the needlework of wealthy white girls in the American South before the Civil War from the slaveocracy those girls lived in, were complicit in, and benefited from. The lack of geographical needlework in the American South and in the United States in general is surprising to me, especially considering how many American schoolgirl samplers feature little houses, and it's even more confusing when one considers the slavery aspect. Southern girls on large plantations were part of families that benefited from global trade, especially from the trade of cotton gathered by enslaved individuals. So surely wouldn't it be beneficial to understand the geography of that global trade? To understand where in the world those materials were being shipped and what was being sent back in return? I don't know, maybe that's just me. But it's not that girls weren't learning geography at all. They were, they just weren't learning it through needlework. Maybe girls needed to learn where they were in the world, but they didn't need to stitch themselves there. I'm clearly not an expert on this subject, but Emily is, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what she makes of geographical needlework and the lack thereof in the next few years as she works to complete her PhD. Book about Southern geographical education and needlework incoming, I hope. And just as a last thought before I leave you all, speaking of books, I have to mention a new book that has just come out about Ashley Sack, which we talked so much about in this episode. The book is called All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, A Black Family Keepsake, and it was written by the brilliant Tia Miles, professor of history and Radcliffe alumni professor at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study. I am so beyond happy that there's finally a book about such an important piece of textile history. That's not really a conclusion, but that is where I will conclude this episode. Now go out and stitch some stories and embroider a globe, because really, truly, West Town globes are the coolest things on the entire planet. Bye!